I'm Bill Barole. Over the last few decades, I've done every kind of writing there is to do, from journalism to humor, books, movies, and television.
I'm Matt Ricardo. For the last 30 years, I've toured the world as a variety performer.
We've come together across the Atlantic to talk about creativity, what it is, where it comes from, why it matters.
Thomas Edison said, "To invent, you need a good imagination and a pile of junk."
This is Imagination and Junk, a conversation about the hard work of creativity.
Episode 22, Watch Out for the Shoe. Dear Bill, Barbara Windsor was a legendary British actress. She learned her craft at Joan Littlewood's theatre workshop at the Theatre Royal Stratford East before becoming a household name thanks to her tough and saucy turns in the Carry On films throughout the 60s and 70s. She was brilliant. A London girl through and through, with a breathy, gurgling laugh and the ability to do broad comedy, but also, on those rare times when it was asked of her, real heartbreaking pathos. After she'd left the Carry On franchise, she ended up creating another unforgettable role as Peggy Mitchell, feared matriarch of the Mitchell clan and landlady of the Queen Vic in the British soap opera EastEnders, and she became a huge star all over again. But there was quite a gap between those two halves of her career, and for a good deal of that gap, she found herself in the unenviable position of being very famous, but not hugely in demand. And this, dear listeners, was when our paths crossed. In the very early 90s, I toured the country with a Victorian music hall show. A recreation of the great British working-class variety shows of the turn of the century. There was sing-along music, character comedy, sketches, and a young juggler getting his first taste of big theatres and learning all he could from the battalion of old troopers who'd been doing this for decades. I loved it. Now, there was also a headline act, and usually this would be someone from TV. A known celebrity whose name would help sell tickets and who could perform a tribute to an old music hall star. And one of the regular headliners was Barbara Windsor. I worked with her off and on for a couple of years and I adored her. She was exactly as you'd want her to be, a hard-working, take-no-shit, foul-mouthed delight. And I think she liked me, mostly. There was one night when she didn't. That night, I arrived at the theatre to be taken aside by Ian, the host and producer of the show, and told that I'd be singing a duet with Barbara at the finale of the show. I don't sing. No, I can't sing. Look, I'm a modern vaudevillian, I can do a bit of everything except singing. Not remotely, not at all. Ian knew this. I told him this. I told him this in increasingly desperate and assertive tones. I pleaded. Perhaps he thought I was being modest. I wasn't. Maybe he thought it would be a good learning experience for me. Oh, it was. He handed me the lyrics to You Made Me Love You, with my solo bits underlined, and told me to give it my all and vanished. Listen, you might think you've had an interaction with a celebrity. But until you've stood in front of a sold-out theatre audience with a live band playing and absolutely murdered a song while staring into the eyes of one of the nation's sweethearts, you don't know shit. I got to my first solo line and decided to give it everything. And it had all the beauty and nuance of the Foghorn of the Titanic. Barbara stared at me. Her expression one of incredulity, shocked disbelief, genuine bafflement at what was happening here and how dare it be. I must have looked terrified. We finished the song and offstage I apologised profusely. I told her what had happened and I told her that I knew I couldn't sing and she told me that I was right. And she giggled that giggle and I was never asked to sing again. So, this week on Imagination and Junk, we're going to talk about doing things you're not good at. Of course, the thing is that everything you are good at, you started out not being good at. Nobody comes out of the womb being able to do, well, anything, really. So the story of being good at something is inherently the story of also not being good at it. But it's not a digital concept. There's not good or not good and nothing else. There's shades of grey. As we've already established, I can't sing. Couldn't back in the 90s with Barbara and still can't, but I still sing to myself around the house all the time. I think I sound marvellous, but I'm wrong. When I was a kid, there was a piano in the back room of my grandmother's house. When my mum would visit, I'd be left to my own devices while they chatted over a cup of tea, and I'd wander off, climb up on the piano stool and plink-plonk away. These days, I can play piano. I mean, not well, and probably with all the wrong techniques since I was never taught. Well, unless you count playing along to Kids from Fame records, which I do. But I enjoy those moments when I'm on tour and I find a piano backstage and I play a little. I'm not good, but I'm as good as I need to be to make a non-horrific sound. And, more importantly, to make myself happy. So, who decides how good we are at something? Sometimes we don't need anyone to tell us. Either you can do a backflip or you can't. But for most things, there are those pesky shades of grey again. So we have to look elsewhere for grading. To an audience, to a trusted friend, to ourselves if we can be honest enough. And if we find out that we're not good at something that we want to be good at, how do we react? Sadness at the failure or renewed motivation for the road of learning ahead? You made me love you. I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it. You made me want you. And all the time you knew it. I guess you always knew it. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt. Okay. Let me tell you the story of how I ended up making my public debut as a musician, accompanied by a trio of steely-eyed West Coast session pros, one of whom was, for years, the touring accompanist for actual professional musical performer, Anne Margaret. As we've discussed, I play the ukulele. Well, that may be overstating things. What I do is plunk weakly away in a manner that produces something approximating music, in the same way that the transmogrifying portal in the 1986 movie The Fly produced a stake. Which is to say, it's recognizable as music, what I make. It has the general shape and form of music, but it doesn't really taste like music. But I do it because I like the solitary challenge of it, and the little moments of reward I get from landing a difficult chord transition or executing a nice little fill. However, as we've discussed before on this podcast, it is a thing I do in private for me, with only one exception. Every Christmas morning, I do sing and play the Andrews Sisters' Christmas Island for Jennifer. I do this for a simple reason. She asks me to. In a marriage, particularly one in which one partner asks very little of the other, there are some things you do simply because you're asked to. So I do this. And Jennifer understands that this is a special thing just between us. Except for one time. One time, my wife, whom I love, asked me to make my horrifying plunky sounds outside the safety and security of our own home. She did this in the most devious possible way, by making it not about her, but about the happiness of a dear friend on his birthday. It was a dirty trick to pull on a guy. Here's the backstory. Our friend Mark Perry grew up in Georgia, fascinated with TV, especially reruns of the old Dick Van Dyke Show. He was particularly taken with the episodes in which Rob and Laura Petrie would throw a house party for their talented show business friends, who would get up in the Petrie's perfect mid-century suburban living room and perform, sing a song, do a little dance, tell some jokes. Mark never got over the glamour and the sheer fun of it. Years later, now a successful TV writer himself and living in a beautiful streamlined modern house in the Los Feliz section of LA, Mark decided to do the same on his birthday. He didn't do this every year. It was just too big a production for that. Mark and his husband Mark Knowles would open the evening with a choreographed musical number. There'd be a run of show order mapped out. People would perform a little something as their birthday gift. I remember one woman one year who played Over the Rainbow on a saw. And every year, Mark would end the evening with an upscale, finger-snapping rendition of Bobby Darin's Artificial Flowers that would bring down the house. And all of it, because our friend Mark commits to the bit, would be accompanied by a trio, led by pianist Nick Fryman, who had, yes, for some time toured with legendary singer-dancer Anne Margaret as her accompanist. It was all exactly as fabulous as it sounds. Now, Jennifer is a fearless person, socially adept, good in crowds. I'm none of these things, as you know. So our contributions would usually take the form of specialty musical numbers in which she and I would collaborate on lyrics celebrating Mark on his birthday. And she would get up and sing them, and always kill, while I would hide behind a column and watch with a mix of pride and awe. And then I'd take the co-lyricist's modest bow and go refill my glass. This year, however, Jennifer, for whatever reason, asked me to accompany her on the ukulele, which I'd been playing at that point badly, let me remind you, for about a year. What was I going to do? I said yes. I think I was so absolutely paralyzed with fear at the notion of getting up in front of 30 or 40 people, the vast majority of them strangers, and doing this thing I'd ever only done in my own living room for my own amusement, that I didn't focus on the fact that I would also be getting up in front of three actual, no-fooling, professional Los Angeles musicians, which is, if you think about it, much more terrifying. Jennifer and I had worked up some lyrics to the tune of I Can't Give You Anything But Love, which was one of the few songs I could fake all the way through using tabs. And when, on the night, my turn came and Nick politely asked me what key I'd be playing in, and I told him I didn't know, he nodded and said they'd fall in as appropriate. Which they did, without laughing. At least I assume they didn't laugh, because remember, they were pros. All I could hear was a wash of white noise, my own tinnitus in my ears, and the sound of my heart hammering in my chest. And then it was over. Once again, Jennifer killed. As for my part, people were kind. I managed to escape the stage in one piece and head straight for the bar, where I remained for the next 6 weeks. Perry's housekeeper dusted around me. It was fine. Here's what I remember about that night that's germane to our topic. You responded to your moment by leaning in. You lived the old line variously attributed to Bob Dylan and Tom Petty. If you can't sing, sing loud. There's also a line I like from Mel Brooks, another great leaner in. If you're going to climb the tower, ring the bell. What I did, of course, was nothing of the sort. I tried, and I mean physically tried, to get smaller, to be less there. I turtled my head into my shoulders so deeply that my neck ached for days. And now I wonder, why do some people lean in when they find themselves in a situation where they're doing something they're bad at, while others, well, turtle? What did you know as a performer that I didn't know? And what did you get out of your experience, in addition to a great story, that I didn't get out of mine? I'll talk to you next time. Bill.
Dear Bill, I enjoyed your last segment very much, the noble pain of doing something you find uncomfortable for someone you love. But mostly, I'd like to thank you for giving me reason to go to YouTube and type in Anne Margaret Dancing. Hoo boy. Anne Margaret Dancing. I mean, there's been a lot of talk here in Brexit-crippled Britain about the growing difficulty in getting reliable, long-term access to certain medications. And all I can say is that I'd rather continue having access to my antidepressants, but if that does become impossible, well, Anne Margaret Dancing. Sorry, I got distracted by Anne Margaret Dancing. I'm sorry, it happened again. Where was I? Oh yes, these parties you've been to sound very fun. And someone played the saw. Here's a question for you. We've known each other for a few years now, so consider this a test. Do you think I can or cannot play the saw? You ask what it is that made me lean in where you shrunk down, and the obvious answer would be a startling lack of common sense, but there is, I hope, a little more to it. Shrinking down, turtling up when you feel uncomfortable is basically the right thing to do. The natural thing, at least. But being a professional performer teaches you the tricks to getting away with things. And just to be clear, these are not infallible techniques. When I sung, and I use that term loosely, with Barbara Windsor, I did not, in any way, get away with it. But maybe I did manage to mitigate the damage done slightly. If you can't sing, as is the case with me, then employ all the things you can do. All the sleight of hand that show business has been built on forever. Confidence, big eyes, stagecraft, head held high, show no fear. Even if you're all over the place pitch-wise, maybe, if you're showing Olympic levels of self-assurance, people won't trust their own ears. It's about having confidence in spite of the amount of skill you have, not because of it. It's like they say in the song Razzle Dazzle from the musical Chicago, long as you keep 'em way off balance, how can they spot you've got no talents? I think it's one of the first important things that a performer realises, and it's all part of the it's not so much what you do but how you do it deal, that artistry and craft, real artistry, wrapped around a mediocre technical talent, can, if it's done in the right way, enhance it to the point that it transcends the sum of its parts and becomes its own thing. You mentioned Mel Brooks, and he's the perfect example.
The Inquisition.
Let's begin.
The Inquisition.
Look out, sin.
We have a mission to convert the Jews. We're gonna teach them.
He sings a lot, and he's not very good at it. But he puts so much chutzpah into it, such panache, such gusto, such verve, that the quality of his voice becomes completely unimportant compared to the performance as a whole. The opposite of this is much more obvious, I think. The nervousness of someone who is, for example, good at singing, but with every other molecule of their presence on stage, gives off vibes that say they don't think they should be there. Well, that's quite often a worse situation to be in. Knowing you can't sing, but giving it tits and teeth and running at it with all the pizzazz you can muster isn't going to make you a better singer, but it might make for a better performance. But if you can sing, but you're flop sweaty, staring at your shoes, fear is taking over, well, then you might just lose confidence in your voice, too. What did I get out of my experience? Well, yeah, mostly a funny story, but also, if I'm honest, a decent helping of shame. I really liked Barbara, and I didn't want her to think that I was under the impression that I could sing, that I deserved to be there stinking up the place right next to her on stage. I felt that I'd been put in a position that insulted her, and I wanted her to know that I hadn't had a choice. Perhaps I should have refused, but I was very young. I was grateful for the work, and I was scared of boat rocking. I'm one of those people who likes to be good at things and doesn't like to do things I'm not good at least not professionally, not in front of people. My job is to be professionally good at things, so if people have handed over money because they think I'm worth watching, then it's down to me to make damn sure I am. There's a brilliant piece of footage of Sammy Davis Jr. on stage. He comes out dressed as a cowboy, Stetson hat, gun belt, silver Colt 45 in the holster, and he sings lazily The Streets of Laredo.
As I walked out in the streets of Laredo.
And while he sings, he does some really good, fancy quick draws, getting more and more complicated between each line of the song. And the audience don't quite know how to react until finally, as a group, they decide to burst into applause. At which point he stops, turns to them with a grin, and says,
"Shucks, I wouldn't put it on unless I was good at it."
But I guess if you're not good, and you find yourself doing something in front of people anyway, then, well, like they say in Razzle Dazzle, give them an act with lots of flash in it, and the reaction will be passionate. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt,
Okay, a couple of things. Based on the way you phrased the question, as well as the fact that you're a person who masters unusual skills for a living, I'm going to say this is a sucker's bet. Yes. Yes, I believe that you can play the saw. The fact that saw playing is not, as far as I can tell, a regular part of your cabaret act doesn't undercut this belief. It only confirms that saw playing is not a, how can I put this, not a traditional crowd pleaser. Also, you talked about, quote, these parties I've been to, which makes my life in Los Angeles sound drastically more fabulous than it actually is. The only parties like these that I've ever been to are the ones that my friend Mark throws, and it's precisely the fact that they're sort of unreal, like something out of a TV show, because they literally are. It's only this that gets me out of the house for them at all. I am not Rob Petrie, nor any of his glamorous show business friends. I'm more the Mel Cooley type. Oh, also, before I forget, thanks for introducing me to the phrase tits and teeth, which I will now almost certainly misuse in a failed attempt to seem more with it than I am. With all due respect, which is a thing people say over here when they're about to profoundly disrespect someone, our two humiliations were not equivalent. You had the formidable tools of an experienced entertainer to bring to bear when you got dragooned into singing a duet with a beloved musical comedy star. You had confidence, or at least the ability to convincingly fake it because tits and teeth... No? Not right? Sorry, I'll start again. You had tools to help you bring it off, is what I'm saying. I had no tools, not even a basic command of the ukulele, which was really too bad because I was standing up there specifically and expressly to play the ukulele, while your performance was a part of your job, or at least was within shouting distance of it. Shouting distance might have been a good way to describe where you were standing relative to Miss Windsor, now that I think about it, but never mind. The point is, you were at work. My performance, if you want to call it that, was something else. Something more in the way of an offering, a thing that impressed, if it did at all, only to the degree that it was apparent I had no business being there. That's a situation most non-performers, which is, after all, most of us, sorry, it's true, can relate to. And what I want to try to figure out about it is, what is it we non-pros can get out of being in this situation? The first thing was, in this particular case, it was an expression of affection for my friend Mark on his birthday, and that always feels good. Unless you're a sociopath, I guess. But there's something else, at least on paper. Public humiliation can be a powerful object lesson in the essential silliness of self-consciousness. And that can be fantastically liberating for creative people. It can free us of the conviction that whatever we're doing at a given moment is undergoing the laser-like scrutiny of a world that, if we were to look at it dispassionately, doesn't really care about us all that much. The false conviction that it does, well, that's only egocentricity. You know the expression, dance like no one's watching? It's good advice in a bumper sticker kind of way, but the truth is, guess what? No one is watching. Unless you're extremely, extremely good. Believe me, people have better things to do than focus their attention on terrible dancers, or bad singers, or bad writers, or bad ukulele players. The whole world is not watching. And what do we have to do to take advantage of this lesson? It's very simple. Just let go. Let go of the conviction that you are the focal point of a world which is, I'm sorry to tell you this, indifferent to you. Nobody remembers that I was terrible on the ukulele that night, not exactly. What they remember, if anything, is that I was terrible, and I did it anyway. That small adjustment in perspective can, if I allow it to, unlock something. And that little bit of license can be put directly into the next act of creation. Let it go, and go make something. I'll talk to you next time. Bill.
Dear Bill. Oh yeah, it was a pretty safe bet. Unless I was hustling you. And figured that you'd assume I can play the saw because it seems on the money for me, but in fact, no, I can play the saw. Leslie bought one for my birthday a few years ago with, I think, the kind of attitude of, it seems odd that you can't already play one of these and don't already have one, so you may now rectify that. I've played it in public exactly one time, backing some live musicians on a Tom Waits song, and also I contributed a solo to an album by my friend Tricity Vogue. And yes, Tricity Vogue named herself after a kitchen appliance. I love cabaret. And I'm glad you love tits and teeth. It gives me an excuse to tell you about the pro wrestler Tony Storm. Oh. Her current character is that of a Sunset Boulevard-style faded Hollywood star, and she's brilliant at it. She gives over-dramatic pre-match interviews full of old Tinseltown catchphrases, and then ends with a stirring cry of, "Chin up, tits out, and watch for the shoe," at which point she takes her shoe off and hurls it at the interviewer. She's a genius. Anyway, how dare you? How dare you claim that your humiliation was worse than mine? You were in front of friends in a social engagement, the very dictionary definition of a friendly, supportive audience. I was in front of a theatre full of paying customers who had paid for people who could do what they were on stage to do, which I could not. Money had changed hands. You may have suffered embarrassment, but I could have been sued for misrepresentation of myself as a singer. But you're right. The trick is not to care. The decision not to care is the thing that simultaneously stops you being so traumatized that you never do anything in front of people again, and at the same time gives you the screw it confidence that goes a long way to carrying you through whatever you're bad at with panache. Panache, of course, being French for tits and teeth. You can always tell a good comedy performer, especially a good physical comedy performer, a good clown, by how much they care about themselves during the performance. A good clown never gives a shit about how cool or stylish or adult or composed they look when performing. If they did, they'd never take a pie in the face. They'd never fall down. They're able to make the mental leap of knowing it's not about them, it's about the gag. It's about the show. Even if the gag makes them look stupid or clumsy or useless. But I think it's true for every kind of artist. Maybe it's as simple as, if you're thinking about yourself, you're thinking less about the art. You didn't get up to play at that party to stun them with your wicked shredding on your uke or your Mariah Carey-style vocal range. You did it because you knew it would make your friends happy. And it did. Because the beauty of a heartfelt performance transcends the technical skill of the performer every time. The secret is that even the most technically accomplished performers would happily give a couple of toes to be able to achieve the kind of authentic relationship that you had with your friends during that song. That's what we all learn those skills for, to try and trick people into loving us. The theme for this episode, at least in our group chat, was doing things that you're bad at. And here's the thing as I see it. In terms of measurable skills, there are things that you, me, everyone is good and bad at. I'm better at juggling than you, you're better at the ukulele than me. But this is a podcast about creativity. So in the wider sense, in the sense of being artists and makers, do the same rules apply? If you decide to make something creative, artistic, and then you do, isn't that kind of, you know, it? If you sit down and draw a picture of a bunny, and you think and feel about how you want to do that, and you choose the materials and the pose of the bunny, and then you do it, you've done it. You've succeeded. You're not bad at it because you did it. Might the resulting picture not be sellable? Sure, but that's nothing to do with artistry, that's capitalism. Might the resulting picture not look like you wanted it to look? Yeah, but that's not failing at being creative. That's being creative, knowing how your art should progress. Have other people throughout history made better pictures of bunnies? Maybe, but again, that's nothing to do with success or failure as an artist. That's just being suckered into the comparison being the thief of joy bullshit that the boring parts of society try to force on you. Doing things you're bad at? Here's what I think. In art, there's no such thing. If you do it, you're not bad at it because you did it. As you say, ignore all the other flotsam and jetsam and keep making. Chin up, tits out. And watch for the shoe. Talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, I think you know I'm not much of a pro wrestling fan. But Norma Desmond as a wrestler? Well, you don't have to be an aficionado of the squared circle to be tickled by that one. There's something so right about the faded glamour of a 1940s movie queen being reframed for a modern audience. Here in L.A., the screen idols of the past are sometimes the old guy you see tottering across a Wilshire Boulevard crosswalk, as William Powell was for my friend Tim Noah in the late 70s. Although Tim was less starstruck than he was amazed that William Powell was still alive in the late 1970s. Another friend of mine, Janice Hirsch, lived downstairs from Betty Davis in a Hollywood apartment building, and once watched her endure a coughing jag so severe it seemed like she might topple off her balcony and land in the swimming pool. The stars, as the American glossy magazine Us Weekly used to gush, they're just like us. Let's not get into a shouting match about whose embarrassment was more profound. But I do want to correct the record. I was not standing up at that party, plunking away on my ukulele in front of a crowd of friends. It was, with the exception of Jennifer, Mark, and Mark, a crowd of strangers, which, as I said earlier, is much more terrifying, and in front of actual professional musicians, which is infinitely more terrifying. Let's just say we were both embarrassed, although you almost certainly did a better job of hiding the fact. I'm guessing, for example, that your face didn't get so red and hot that someone could successfully cook a grilled cheese on it, as mine did. Anyway, it isn't a competition. Although, if it were a competition, I would win. So let's leave it there and talk instead about authenticity. I'm struck by how often the notion of authenticity seems to come up in this ongoing conversation of ours. And it's done so once again here. You talked about the authentic relationship I had with my friends in that moment. Here's what I think that means. I knew I was going to be bad. And I was. I did it anyway. The audience had no expectation that I'd be good. And I wasn't. They liked it anyway. Why? Because I'd made the effort. The effort was my gift for Mark's birthday. And it was the very badness of my performance that made that connection between the audience and me. I've tried to remember that every time since then that I've had occasion to get up in front of people and do something in which I had less than perfect confidence. I think this is what you meant when you said, if you do it, you're not bad at it, because you did it. I like that. If you're going to be creative, create. You might be bad. You might be real bad. But you'll be real. And if you are, you've succeeded. I'll talk to you next time. Bill. Imagination and Junk is written by Bill Barole in the U.S. and Matt Ricardo in the U.K., with audio production by Bill Barole. For more information, show notes, and bonus content, it's imaginationandjunk.com.